You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, we are going to talk about making the choice to leave a professional career with my guest, Julie Cole.
Hey, happy to be here and bring all my imperfection with me.
Very good. Talking about imperfection,
there's a lot of that.
I'm going to change your name right here in the live feed, which I've been, this is a new tool. Let's try this. Much better. Welcome to the Art of Imperfect Adulting, Julie Cole. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I sure am. I'm ready for it.
Love that. This was the first new run of show like that, and my heart was pounding a little tiny bit because I had no idea if it worked. Thank you for your patience, everybody. I start all my conversations with my guests with the same two questions. Share with us what part of the world you call home.
So I am currently sitting in a place called Burlington, Ontario, which is just outside of Toronto, and it's very cold right now.
Very cool. I did some research for you before we talked, and I think that you've lived all over the world. But share with us something that you like right now about where you're living. Not the cold, it doesn't sound like.
No, I. You know what? The cold is, it's just getting a bit much by this time, and it's been an extra cold winter. But I will say, had a little break from the cold on Friday and caught up with some girlfriends and went skiing. So that's what I like about the weather. And you know what are about living where I live? And we do try to remind ourselves that there's no bad weather, just bad clothing.
100%. That is definitely something that makes more sense when you live in a place with adverse conditions. But it is true. It is absolutely true. The right gear. I live in the almost tropics, and it's the opposite. Same sort of thing. It's like the right gear for things makes a huge difference. I just, instead of having snow pants, have like scuba gear. So
trade ya.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to talk about making the choice to leave your professional career. Let's start here. Share with us what you studied for a profession.
Right. Okay. So, you know, I studied lots of things. I did an undergrad, I went to grad school, then I went to law school. So I was in law and I left it. I joke, I'm a recovered lawyer. There was no 12-step program, so I don't have to apologize to anyone except myself for what I put myself through. Maybe my parents, because that was a lot of education. But yes, I started my professional career in law, but quickly did a detour out.
Very good. Very good. So what kind of law did you think you were going to do, or did you do?
So I was doing mostly family law. That was my area of interest. I was working out women's legal service, and I really thought I would be that in that space for a very long time, although I know there's a high risk of burnout. But that was my happy space and what I studied. I did a lot of like feminist legal theory, and that's where my interest was. So I thought I would be there for a while, and that caught cut very short.
That is very interesting. I have so many questions to go along with that. Ooh. How long, the question is, backing up, how long did you work as a lawyer?
I didn't work that long because I was actually, after my first year of law school, I had my first child. And then I think it was during my articles that I was pregnant with my third. So I practiced for about a year before there was a big change in our lives that made me think, okay, maybe this is not going to suit us anymore. So it was a very short time. And, you know, for that reason, a lot of people, you know, wonder, was it worth going? You know, you spent all that time at law school, you only practice for such a short time. But I tell people all the time, you know, whatever you learn, whatever schooling you do, you bring the lessons to whatever you're doing next. So there's no regrets. Like sometimes I'm like, law school to label making, really? Like, or diaper changing, like with the six kids. So, but I have brought so many of those lessons with me, and they have been applicable in entrepreneurship and also, you know, mediating all my humans and having to negotiate with them.
Fair point. Fair point. And you touched on a lot of things there. I think that as somebody who's hearing your story and is not a lawyer, but has many people in the family who've gone down at least that education path, I would say there are two things. I'm with you. Like, I think that question when we ask people that it's like, do you use the skills of what you study? Because sometimes you're like, oh, I don't. But there's a lot of truth to the fact that, you know, most secondary education, college and a graduate school, sounds like it's job training, but it's often not. So you just carry that skill set into whatever you're using. But lawyers, you know, it is an investment in time. And you do have licensure and all of that stuff. And so, but I would say that, you know, working for a year and making the, just, I don't know, the number of women who I know who went to law school, worked as lawyers, and then stopped after a short amount of time is enormous. I don't know. I have no explanation. But anyway, the job of being a lawyer, famously intense. Law school is intense. The job is intense. Doesn't always match up with quality life and family for men or women. But share with us, it sounds like you did have some thinking about this even as a student. What was, if you remember, your thinking when you were thinking about being a lawyer, going into family law, what was your thinking about family? Like, you know, what were your thoughts about how it was going to work for you?
Yeah, I don't know that I really thought a lot about that. And I think we do know that there's a care gap still. We still know that women are doing most of the caregiving within their families. They're the default parent. They're carrying the invisible load. We know that through research. Slowly that stuff is changing. But I also have talked to so many professional women and, you know, female lawyers in my time. And there's a lot of, wow, if I knew how hard this was going to be when I had a family, because also the workforce isn't, the traditional workforce isn't set for women professionals. Right. It is set for, you know, that 1950s male professionals who have a full-time human at home taking care of all the things. So we're doing that thing where, you know, we're trying to work as though we don't have children and trying to raise our kids as though we don't have work. And it's difficult. It's problematic.
Yeah, I will say, totally off topic, when I read your bio, and we'll jump into the size of family you had. When I read your bio, I had no idea what type of person, I never know. It's the first conversation I have with people. I had no, where you would have fallen into the, you know, feminist spectrum. So my mind is exploding with questions. But so you went to law school. Where in this process did you guys actually start your family? Did you have kids while you were in law school, or was it after?
Yeah, so it was during, the first one was born after maybe second year, first or second year. And then I did have them close in age. So I was, you know, expecting my third while I was doing my articles. So I did pack them in tight as well. But I liked being a student and doing the early mom thing as well. That seemed to, I was that mom who, like, you know, I wore my baby's, like, Posey went to her first feminist legal theory class when she was 1 week old. Like, I was very okay with that. But then the workforce changed it. And for me, particularly what happened was that my eldest child was diagnosed with autism. So not only is the traditional workforce not, you know, entirely suitable or helpful or accessible or all of those things for working mothers, but when you have a child who has a neurodiversity or has a disability or has anything up with them, that gap widens even more, because you have appointments, you have physio, you have therapy, you have all these things, and it's just, you know, how to fit it in. And of course, because, you know, women are still that care gap, and we're the ones who are really still taking care of these things. We take care of most of the child related experiences and issues in families. That tends to fall on us. So at that point is when made that decision. But also going along with that, I was always already talking to my sister and two of our friends about this business idea that we had. So it was like I left law, but to be able to, you know, provide for my kiddos in a way that I wanted to, but also, you know, I had professional aspirations. I didn't want to give that up in its entirety, and had a good business idea. So I just needed more flexibility, and that's what entrepreneurship would provide.
All right, we're going to come back to that. I have a follow-up question on this, because you used a word that I didn't quite know what it meant, but I think I have a theory about what it is. You talked about doing your working on your articles. So I think that where did you study law school in the United States, or are you, is it a different place?
Right. So in Canada, Australia, sort of those okay. Commonwealth countries, you do a year of articles, which means you've graduated, but you work with a lawyer, and it's actually a really meaningful year, because that's, hey, like anything, okay. that's where you do all the learning, right?
Sure. No. And that's, I'm glad I asked, because that just for the people who are in the audience and are more right. familiar with the U.S. system, because it is like med school and law school, these epically famous hard programs. So it's a slightly different. All right. So to recap, you're in law school, you're starting a family, you're doing these things. You're aware of workplace issues. You're discovering it through your own life. I wanted to backtrack about that. You talked about it, and so I'm going to ask you to go into more depth. Talk to us a little bit about your ideas when you were in law school and a new lawyer about business. And the reason I have this question is just because of the people I know who've gone to law school and are lawyers, most of whom are in the United States, obviously, because that's where I live. They are not always aware of the business parts of even being a lawyer. And so as somebody who shifted from being a lawyer to being in business, I wanted to ask you, where did that start? And there's, yeah, so share.
Right. And well, and it's interesting too, because people start businesses for different reasons. Some people are just very entrepreneurial, and that's why you get serial entrepreneurs, because they're always having ideas and they love that early stage, that building, the getting the funding, that, you know, they love playing in that space. And then some people do it because of necessity, they have a good idea, it suits them. So I feel like I fall into that latter category. I never thought I was going to be entering the world of entrepreneurship. It came from a necessity of a life change, and also a good idea of a product that was missing from the market. So I was not thinking about entrepreneurship when I was going through law school. I thought I would work legal aid. I thought I would be, you know, that sort of thing. That's what I always thought. And it really, that mind switch really did happen when the family came along, and then we had some changes.
Very interesting. I appreciate you taking the time to update us with that. I love the fact that you mentioned that you had a good idea. Sometimes when I'm talking to people about podcast ideas or business ideas, I will occasionally say, I think the hardest thing to do is to actually have a good idea. And one of the things I throw out there is, I don't think that most of us know if we have a good idea until we put it out into the world. So it's like, I think that all of my ideas are great. They don't all catch on. So, okay. So you have led us into this. There's two things going on here with your family. One is you have a large family. You have six kids. And so the follow-up question to that is, and I have a fairly large family, not quite as large as yours, so there's no implied judgment of any type in this. Like, was it the plan? Was it a childhood dream to have a big family, like, or did you fall in love with this, and change your mind along the way?
Right. So I really think that it was one of these things where I had a good experience growing up with, I was one of four. Okay. Daddy-o had a good experience. He was the eldest of five. So we probably thought, oh, we'll probably have like, you know, three or four. That would probably make sense. Like, we probably thought we'd have more than two. And I think just what happened was that every time we had one, we're like, this is great, and we're managing fine. And, you know, like, but I was that annoying person who had one kid and was like, I need to have another one because one's a bit, like, boring. There's not enough going on.
Sounds a little bit about the puppy experience. It's like, I need a dog, right? And then the dog needs a friend, and the dog's friend
exactly.
needs a friend.
Exactly. So, you know, we'd have these babies and then be like, you know, not even a year later, be like, oh, this is great. We should do this again. And it was funny because I had so many people say to me, oh, you'll know when you're done. You'll know. Like, because people would give me their maternity clothes when they're like, just had their second. I'm like, how do you know? And they're like, you'll know. But I didn't have the I'm done gene. I never felt done. And unfortunately, most people have a partner who will have the I'm done gene and shut things down. But none of us had the I'm done gene. Even the kids were like, when's the next baby? So it eventually just got ridiculous. Like, you know, I was old and I had six C-sessions, and it was like, okay, we got to call this a day, right? Like, so it was just a lot of fun. And honestly, like, now I'm through all the hard parts. I have to admit, like, I didn't sleep for 10 years. Like, there was no sleep. There was nothing like that. I mean, I always had somebody like puking or with lice. Like there was always something, but I didn't, I don't know, it was okay. Like I didn't mind it so much. And I had a lot of fun. I enjoyed every stage. And now I've got five in college and one
Okay.
in high school. So this is dead easy. It's expensive, buy more labels, but it's dead, like comparatively. Like I sleep, I have my tea still hot when I drink it. Like, people always say bigger kids, bigger problems. I'm like, no, nah, I don't think so. I think this is pretty cruisy, but I've enjoyed every stage, and every stage has its challenges, just like running a business. You have different, as your business grows, your family grows, it's amazing how many parallels there are.
I hear all of that. I definitely do. Okay, so you mentioned this. One of your kids has special needs. The special needs are autistic. Did I hear you say that it's the eldest?
Yes.
Okay, so then the follow-up question is, because it relates to you choosing to, I think, exit from your law career. How early did you figure this out, and how did it influence the decision?
Right. So Mac got diagnosed when he had just turned three. And at that point, I had done my research and I knew, the impact of early intervention, having a parent who was a really strong advocate. And I was just like, look, I got to lean in because, I love my children, but I do want to be an empty nester one day. I want them all gone. So I thought if I do like the work now, maybe that will be in his future, but you don't have a crystal ball, with any of your kids, right? So you never know. I'm like, is he going to be able to have relationships? What is this? What's the impact going to be academically, job wise, that sort of thing? And you don't know any of these things, but like any of your kids, you do whatever you can to make them the best little person they are and give them the opportunities. And it's, of course I accepted his autism. I accept all my kids for how they are, but I'm also going to put expectations and demands and make them do things, do hard things, right? Like that's how that goes. So right away started like a 40-hour a week ABA program. Everybody in my family had required reading. They all knew what was on Mac's program. They came to team meetings. The school was, I mean, on board. Everybody, like, I know that the school was like, they did not want to see this ugly mug turning up at the office. So they kind of did what I one and done, right? So advocacy is a full-time job. And I took that seriously, and I'm definitely reaping the rewards of that now.
All right, so that's the story. Clearly, this is not a new story. This is the oldest kid is in college through college. This is an adult now that we're talking about, which has some implications on how this experience played out for you, because 20 years ago, our knowledge about autism and how we handled it was probably very different. And I mean, it's not a firsthand experience for me, but I'm trying to think about. I definitely, yeah. I mean, is that an accurate statement? Like it has shifted a
It's
lot?
completely accurate. And
Okay.
it's interesting because I feel like when Mac was born, it was just at that point where, like, I was glad he wasn't born 5 years earlier. I
Okay.
felt like we were on the cusp of, like, okay, we kind of know what we need to do. We have enough now research that shows us, about the plasticity of the brain and what we can do now to. So I felt like we were in a pretty good position. I was glad he was born when he was. But yeah, now we're talking about a 25-year-old, right?
All right. And so one of the things that, I mean, you're through it, you're on the other side, but for the people in the audience who are not there yet, who have not gone through matriescence, that shift from being a single woman to being a mother, some people never do it, right? Like, so, but
Sure.
you know, let's talk a little bit, and this is off topic for everything, but I want to give you a chance as somebody who's done it repeatedly over and over again to talk about the process of like dealing with the change from what you think motherhood is going to be like to what it's actually like to meet your children where they are. Because one of the very famous times that can be very challenging is when a newborn or a baby has a health diagnosis of any kind, including though autism.
Absolutely. And you know what, Amy? I think it's okay to, take a breath and not feel guilty about grieving what you thought you were going to have. And I certainly did that. When Mac finally got diagnosed, I knew the diagnosis was coming, and then he got it. And I put a team together to go through the process. And then all of a sudden I was like, are you sure it's not just pragmatic semantic disorder? Are you sure it's? And they're like, you're the one who says it's not. I'm like, I know, but for a minute I just want life to be easier for him. And I want to know that you know, nobody wants things to be hard for their kid, and they don't want them to be hard for them.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, he got his diagnosis. He was the same lovable Mac that walked in that door, that left that door after the diagnosis, right? So it doesn't change how you feel about them. It doesn't change how you love them. In fact, in a way, you know, every milestone he hit was such a celebration and just warm. Like, for the first time he got an invitation to a birthday party where I didn't know the mother. I mean, that invitation's in his baby book. Like, that was a big moment to me. Like, he was socially, like, invited to something that I didn't, you know, make happen. So, you know, that there's that, but I think it's okay. Like, for me, you know, it was that moment of denial and then a couple of days of grief.
Yeah.
And then right, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to deal with this? And how are we going to position it? Because I don't want any, you know, people saying, oh gosh, Julie, we're so sorry. So I told everybody what the expectations were, what I needed from them. And then we went with it. But I, you know, I think if you're going to have a child, you must know in some way that whatever child you get, you get. Like, yeah. You don't get to construct this. Like, you get what you get, and you're better off loving the child you have than missing or grieving the child you imagined, because there's so much joy in the ones you have. Like, all my kids are different. All six of them, they're one's different to the other. And that's the sport of it. Like, you have them, you're like, I wonder what this one's going to be like. And sometimes yeah. they're a little crazy, and sometimes you go through hard times, and sometimes there's joy, but that's the kid you got. So meet them where they are and love them and yeah, work with them, make them the best little humans they can be. But acceptance is key.
That's a masterclass in parenting right there, honestly, because what I will just add for the people who are listening to it, who maybe haven't thought about it for the first time, is that I think in my personal experience, that's one of the toughest things about being in a family generally, is allowing people to show up as they are and just accepting them. And so there are more extreme conditions than others, but we all know those families where, like, everybody seems like they're carbon copies of each other. Like, they all play the same sports and they all go to the same schools and things like that. And the kids seem to follow the instructions, you know, without pushback from the adults. And you know, and then there's other families, right? Exactly. I had a conversation with somebody when I had somebody in high school, and they're like, well, I just told them they had to. And I was like, that works for you? Because my kids are like, no, like, I'm not doing it. And I'm like, well, we can have a discussion, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I do, like, I think I probably was that gentle parent, but I definitely had boundaries, right?
Oh, of course,
like, there are some things that are non-negotiable.
Nice.
I think gentle parenting gets a bad rap because people think it's permissive. And, you know, I mean, nobody walked all over me, but I also did yes. honor how they felt and always, like, listened and had conversations and that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
I think it can be done very, very effectively. And I see parents, you know, dying on too many hills, picking the wrong battles. And I'm just like, dude, you are making this so hard on yourself.
Yes. Yeah. No, 100%. Because there is a difference between the discussion of, you know, what do you want to do this afternoon? And, you know, like, it's really important things where it's just like, no, this is just the rule.
That's right. It's like, yeah, you don't want to brush your teeth. Well, it's going to happen. Would you rather I do it for you, or would you like to do it yourself?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like, and then, you know, and those things do change as they get older, because the toothbrushing yeah. conversation, but yeah, no, 100%. All right. Very good. So talk to us about this. Was it a tough decision for you? When you finally sat down, you were like, no, this is it. I'm not going to be a lawyer anymore. I mean, it was a long time ago, so put yourself back
in. It's a long time ago now. It's a long time ago now. I think there were a few things at play. I already, when Mac got his diagnosis, he already had two younger siblings. It was already kind of a gong show. And I was very excited about this business because I was starting it with cool women, including my sister, who is the bomb. And it was exciting because we were bringing a product to market that didn't exist. So there was a lot of fun stuff that was going along with that. I think maybe what I had a harder time letting go of was when I was like, I'm never going back. And when I made peace with that, because I thought, well, I'll put it off. We'll see how the business goes. Because if the business didn't go well, I may have gone back. But it got to the point where the business is doing exceptionally well. We're having great success there. I'm having great success with my kid. I can't mess with these things just because I feel like going back to law, because I didn't even really, I was so fulfilled. But it is interesting when you let go of that, I may never go back, but there's other things that you can do to use those skills, or feel like I'll do, you know, some volunteerism or help friends, like do a separation agreement, or, you know, help my like people with their stuff they're dealing with. So there are ways you can use it, even your own business, right? You can write a shareholders agreement. You can send out a cease and desist. You could be like, hey, we trademarked that, back off, right? So you can still have fun ways to integrate your skills.
That's a really good point. And I think that there's nuance in there for everybody, because one of the things that definitely impacts people, even if you don't start a business, that women should talk about more with younger women. And that's one of the goals of this show, is to cross over generational silos, age group silos, is the impact of leaving a profession for a short amount of time or a long amount of time, and the myths and legends about going back to work. Because there are some professions, including sometimes law, where there's a very real penalty that you pay if you take a break. And you had a successful business, so that decision then, that conversation with yourself was different. You can use the skill set. But for people who are on a, I'm going to use US words and it's not my profession, but like for people who are doctors or lawyers who are on like a professional track, you know, I think it really, and that's not a path I ever did, but I think it really feels like if I step off this train, I'm going to give up my place in line. I'm really going to pay.
And you are.
Yeah. And it's a real story. You are.
And you are. It's like there is, you know, there is like a mother tax, basically.
Yeah.
Because especially in these careers where, you know, things change and they're always evolving, and then you go back and then you're that guy who, like, you know, you drop your kid off at daycare, they cough twice, you get the call. And then you're that guy who has to, don't even write, right?
Like,
and then you
so
have to
funny.
Go get them. I know, I know. So there is, you know, that's very real. And we see that at the level of professional women, there's still like a 36% pay gap at that high leadership level. And it's because there have been years that have been lost, promotions that have been missed. There have been, you know, people taking the mic from us, people hijacking our ideas and presenting them as their own. We need to start calling this stuff out, right?
Yeah.
And we need to call out like the sexism. We need to be bringing out our little micro feminisms. We need to be like, let's use she pronouns every time we talk about a doctor and a lawyer. Let's, you know, let's say things like, oh, he's a male doctor, because people say things like he's a male nurse. So why aren't we saying he's a male doctor? Yeah. So we need to, like, we know this in the professional world, this is true. And in entrepreneurship, the same.
Yes.
Women starting businesses get less than 2% of venture capital funding. Less than 2% who exit our businesses sell for over $1 million, less than 2%. So there are also more gaps hitting us there because we're not getting funding. So then we can't grow our businesses. And then the only people who are funding our businesses are, you know, that fewer than 2% of women who do a big sale and then invest in us.
Yeah. And you can even back it up for that. That's a very famous statistic about venture funding. And I think if we back it up to the micro businesses that a lot of women start, they're not even aware of how to fundraise or pitch deck or things like that. Like, so it's a whole thing that is, and there are people who are more educated on it, do a better job. I learn it. I study this from other people. So I'm not going to take the conversation that way. Although I could.
Yeah.
You have a business idea while you've got these three little kids. They become six kids, which is Mabel's Labels. So was there a season of you just kind of not being a lawyer and just being a parent? Or did you immediately, you know, on Wednesday say, see a law firm, and Thursday start your business? Like, how did that go?
Yeah, there was no gap. It was, and in fact, often what you'll see with women who like have a side hustle or start a business is that they will hold on. Yeah. They hold on to their traditional job. They're also parenting and they're doing their side hustle. We saw it a lot through COVID as well. Women were starting businesses at incredible rates, but often there's that overlap because there's also the need to feed the humans and pay that mortgage and do those sorts of things. And, you know, the way the economy is and the way, you know,
yeah, and if you live in the States, it's also an insurance thing because we still tie our insurance, our health insurance to employers exactly. For the most part. I mean, I guess that's shifting, but that's, you know, there's very real reasons to keep your corporate attachments.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So you did it at the same time. Tell us about what Mabel's Labels is. Like, tell us the idea and what you do.
Right. Okay. So at the time, you know, I had a few kids. My sister had a couple kids. We, you know, and they're two friends of ours. And we were like, our kids were losing stuff. It was, you know, they go to daycare, they go to playgroup. Everybody's got the same sippy cup. Everybody's got the wipes container and people are using masking tape and permanent marker. And we're like, there's gotta be something out there that's dishwasher safe, microwave safe, you know, personalized so that we stop losing this stuff. And there wasn't. So we got to doing R&D, trying to find material. I had stuff in my dishwasher for a year. Will it go through the dishwasher? Because we knew our market of moms. Like, we want stuff that's going to work, like the secret sauces. Our product says what it's going to do. It was like cheap insurance. If you put one of these Mabel's Labels on your kid's stuff, you're going to get it back. And it's got to be super cute. And so, you know, we made it cute. And then we launched our first label, which was that label that can go through the dishwasher, microwave, and it went on the bottles and those sorts of things that left the house. And of course, now we've expanded into, you know, tons of products, labeling products, like shoe labels, clothing labels, and all that sort of thing. So that was, that's how it started. And we started with a website with one product and we told our friends, hey, go check out this website. You got to remember, Amy, this is like 23 years ago. Yeah. There's no social media. There's like, people are still like, oh, I got to put my Visa on the computer machine. I don't know about that. So it was like, we That's were an true. Early e-commerce business, right? Yeah. So it was, it was a challenging and exciting time, but we did have the advantage of our market being moms in that moms talk about products they love and hate like it's their full-time job. And then we got like the early mom bloggers and the early mom Facebook, like, which was the start of the whole content creation and parenting influencers like that. They were the OGs and we were onto that very, very early because we knew moms would spread the word, and boy, did they ever.
No, that is a fantastic story. Some of that does sound like it's timing. I had forgotten that, but there, for people who were not alive at that time, there was a whole season when shopping carts were like not necessarily safe. And it was a very big advancement when we got like the secure message and we all learned to check for the secure verified shopping cart.
those days?
I mean, I had blocked it from my memory, similar to dial-up internet until you brought it up, but I do actually remember it. And you know, now we have a different version of technology that's happening. I think that when the kids in my gaggle of kids, I was a big Sharpie user for stuff that went to school, but labels, we were big labels. I would buy labels for sleepaway camp under the idea that any of the socks would ever come back, and keeping them for the laundry and stuff like that. And I know that that's one of the things that you do. What's the, because it's expensive, like, so sippy cups are sippy cups, but now everybody is taking, you know, insulated bottles everywhere they go.
And absolutely. And you know, if your kids went to camp, you send all that, like that Gore-Tex suit, that sleeping bag and all of that stuff. And you do want that stuff coming back, and the camp doesn't want to be left with it. And even from a sustainability and stewardship over your own belongings, we find it, you know, really educational, and kids are doing a good job of it. And you know, if they're going to carry around a $45-$50 Stanley cup, if you're a 13-year-old tween, you got to have a label on that so it comes home. And we also made it really easy because, I mean, if you had you probably had like an iron-on label that you got from Regal or I don't know what, but you know,
I was super lazy. Mine are stickers.
Super lazy. They couldn't have lasted because when we came out with ours, you know, we have so many clothing labels, like peel and stick on a cloth. We have a stamp. So we've really revolutionized it because, you know, modern moms, we don't have time to iron stuff on.
I might have had a stamp. I might have, because the stickers don't last, and I just was lazy about it. I will say, I mean, for people who haven't thought about it, it's not just like losing this stuff. It's also because it's specific to like middle schoolers and maybe high schoolers. They go through a season where they all have exactly the same stuff. It is the weirdest thing in the entire world. I got a call from a kid that was like, I left my shoes, my favorite shoes, in the locker room. Please don't hate me. Go pick up my shoes. So I was like, all right, fine. I will do this one time and just one time, and then you have to learn how to remember your shoes. And part of that is because I buy the shoes and I didn't want to like throw the shoes away. Like I had some skin in this game, right? So I go into the locker room and there's like 20 pairs of the same shoe because they're all wearing the same thing. And so labels are, because, you know, they're all the same
size. To differentiate.
Size.
Well, and also, a lot of schools are uniformed, right?
100%.
And that's like, I even find I come out of yoga and all the moms have the same little UGG yoga and they've started putting their Mabel's labels or their kids' Mabel's labels in their UGG. So when they come out of yoga, they know who's who's.
So this has turned into a promo for labels, but it could be it could be an entire conversation about labels for sure. You do have a special offer that we're going to offer to the audience, which is a coupon for Mabel's labels. And so if folks can find that coupon in the show notes wherever they're listening or watching the show on your audio platform or YouTube, the easiest way to get the links for things like this is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email list, because then once a week when I send you the newsletter, those links are in there, and so you can just click on them. That's my plug to join my community. I do it all the time. Julie, are you ready to wrap this up with my final three questions?
Oh, it depends what they are.
They're just for fun. They're just for fun. Don't be stressed. All right. Very good.
I'm a fun guy.
I'm a fun guy. That's a mom joke if anybody is not listening. That's the punchline to one of the oldest jokes in every family that we do. All right. So do you have a set morning routine? And if so, do you want to share what it is?
I would say it probably is not set, especially now the kids are older. I mean, obviously in the school days, I was very, very routine with my six kids. I had a lot of visuals. I'm not the kind of guy who would be like, get your shoes on. Let me put your school back. Like everybody had a chart. They did what they had to do. I sat there and just, if they looked like deer in the headlights, I'm like, go to your ready, set, go board. I did raise them to be independent little humans because I needed to. There's six of them.
There's
right?
six of them. You are outnumbered.
Yeah, big time. So lots of routines back then. Right now, because a lot of them are away, my mornings are like get up, drop my one kid at school, and either come home, go to the gym, start my work day. I travel a lot with work, so I'm away a lot. I'm not going to be somewhere warm anytime too soon. So it all depends. And that is the life of an entrepreneur, especially when you are the company spokesperson and the head of PR. So you're doing things like, you know, doing media and speaking and writing and turning up and showing up and being visible. So you never know where you're going to find me.
Love that answer. Very, very flexible. Totally contrary to the 5 a.m. rigid routine. I love that answer.
Yes.
All right. Very good. This is actually a question about family vacations that I'm going to ask you. And the reason is I mentioned that I have a pretty big family and I did not figure all the things out from my own. I was very lucky that I would find people every once in a while who had big families like mine who would say, hey, here's a way to do this. So you don't want to pull out your hair. Do you have travel tips for planning vacations based on your experience as a mom of six? So that's eight people traveling when you all go somewhere.
Yeah.
Plus friends and boyfriends and girlfriends.
Right. Yeah. I think when they're little, you need to really remember that they don't really care. Like, you don't have to go and spend a fortune. You know, my neighbor took her three kids to Disney when they were really small. And when they came back, I said, what was your favorite part? And they said it was the little geckos that would walk on the like footpath. And I'm like, and how much did you spend? You know, for us, we always had a family cottage and we had a family ski place. And so what was good about that is that we could leave stuff there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to think about when you're going on family vacation, you're packing for all the people. It's a big job, right? So having a place that already was kind of like a second home, you know, and we would let friends use it or rent it out or whatever, which also made it affordable. So I think when they're really little, you don't put big expectations on yourself. You don't have to do all the things. Don't try and keep up with other people. You know, go off season, buy flights when they're cheaper. Don't do flights. Do what works for you. We do have family in Australia, so we did go fairly regularly. And, you know, I am pretty chill, but that one time I flew, it was 5 weeks out of a fifth C-section. My oldest kid was six, and we flew to Australia. And for me, I was able to do it because my mindset is always, it's one hard day, and I can do anything for one hard day. And I did. And that's, you know, that I think having that mindset as you approach anything is, that's going to be what gets you through it.
No, I think that's really good advice. One of the things that was definitely an adjustment for me is it was shifting from, you know, staying in hotels. And then we hit a point very quickly where we did not fit in hotels. And I was like, how does one vacation when
You don't. And, you know, like, and that was the thing. I did have Disney reach out because I was like, well, how does a family, like, it's just not possible, right? Yeah. And then they reach out. They're like, well, we want to send you. And I was like, okay. So we went down and I'm like, yes, yeah, still, like, great. Thank you. But we could never, like, this is totally cost prohibitive. And also just the world isn't built for families who have even 3, 4, 5, 6 kids, right? Yeah. Like, they're a hotel, you can do, be like, all right, we'll get one hotel, put the two kids in one bed, and we're golden. But once you start getting 3 hotel rooms, or, you know, nobody's got a place. So you, now with Airbnb, it's a lot easier for bigger families too. So there's been a lot of shifts that have happened that are very helpful as my kids have grown.
Love that. No, having a kitchen with, I mean, it's like a game changer for me. For me, just by myself now, I'm like, I don't want to even talk to you if there's no kitchen.
Right. Because honestly, if even feeding the humans, right? Like, mm-hmm. food is so expensive. So if you're going out for every meal, again, cost prohibitive for big families.
100%. All right. So share with me in the audience, either a book or a program, like a podcast, a TV show, a movie, whatever, something that you've enjoyed lately that you think that the people in the audience might enjoy. Just an old school recommendation of something you like that other people might like.
Okay. I got to give a weird one.
Good.
First of all, like, you'll see in the show notes, like, get my book. It's good. It's full of all my tips and all that. But I think, you know, for me, what I've really enjoyed, and I'm not going to give like professional or anything. I'm going to give like what I've learned raising my kids, because I have so many friends who have kids this age now and they don't feel very connected to them. And I'm going to give you my one tip.
Okay.
And it's meet them where they are. So don't try to drag them into your interests or be like, but our family always does this. Do what they're interested in. Right now, I'm having to watch all the Hobbit series because my 16-year-old is obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. So that's something I do with him. I don't want to watch it. I'm really not interested, but I learned the characters' names, and it's something we do together, and it's something we share, and it keeps us talking. So even when they're little, when they tell you about like their boring Pokemon, whatever, be interested, because if you're interested in the little things, they'll tell you the big things later. You never want them to stop talking. So always be interested and meet them where they are instead of dragging them where you are.
That is a pro parenting tip. I give the same advice to anybody who asks. It specifically works with, every age, but it specifically is very helpful if you have a teenager who is pulling off onto their own a little bit and you're trying to figure out how to connect. Instead of saying, oh, well, we used to do this together, or I like baseball, it's like, yes, you know, so, and you'll see it once somebody tells you this tip, you'll see other parents doing it. I learned it from another parent who, interestingly, it was also The Hobbit, just for whatever that's worth, that's what they were reading. It's really a pro tip, and once somebody gives it to you, you'll look around, you're like, oh, that's why that person is so into K-pop or these other things. Right. They've got a teenager. I mean, they might just love it themselves, right? But there's a chance that there's somebody in their family who's super into it, and it gives you a common ground. And it's, I mean, I would call it, it's like an actual hack in like connecting with people.
It's like, and I also think it's very much like, use less like aggressive language with them. Like, people said to me, oh, what's your kid's curfew? And I'm like, I don't use that kind of language. Like, my kids will say, oh, we're going to a party. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, what time do you guys think you're going to be home? They'll be like, oh, how does one sound? I'm be like, oh, you know what? We've got that thing tomorrow. We're leaving for skiing. Why don't you say midnight? Okay, sounds good. But using that word curfew and not being flexible depending on what they're doing, or if they're together, maybe they can stay a little later because, you know, they're keeping an eye on each other, whatever. But I remove all that kind of language, controlling language. I don't use any of that. It's all just conversation.
I'm smiling because I've had like so many ridiculous conversations about late night events with all the kids over there. Sorry, I could talk about that for hours. That's it. Julie Cole, thank you for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.